Welcome to Voice of Albion with Paul Hickman on the White Network.
The far right in Britain still thinks that white people are threatened by waves of black immigration. John Tyndall, the leader of the British National Party, hasn't changed his mind about this in the past 25 years.
Multiracial Britain isn't irreversible. The human will and the human intelligence can avoid disastrous policies if we decide that we should avoid them.
The big idea may have stayed the same, but there's a difference between the old far right and the new. Size. 2 decades ago, Tyndall led the National Front, one of the biggest far right parties in Europe. Now the movement is tiny and divided. This film is about the long journey into oblivion. The decline of the British far right has been defined by one event, the 1979 general election. The National Front has put up a record 300 candidates. But it ended in disaster. Every single candidate lost their deposit.
Well, I remember things being very, very hectic and feeling that we could be on the edge of a breakthrough. But as it turned out, we were not on the edge of a breakthrough. And we suffered a setback. The whole of our cause suffered a setback after the election of 1979.
It was a bitter anticlimax to a decade in which the National Front had seemed unstoppable. Leicester was one of its strongholds, thanks to immigration. Thousands of Asians arrived, expelled from Africa. Within a decade, almost a quarter of the town's population was non-white. Locals were shocked.
I joined the National Front because I felt at the time that the established parties were not taking any notice of, you know, the people. And I felt it was the only way of expressing my views at the time. I think that that people were concerned about feeling foreign in their own environment.
Leicester's local council also opposed immigration. It put an advert in a Ugandan newspaper urging Asians to stay away. The local newspaper agreed. In local elections, the National Front rose from nothing to take almost a fifth of the vote.
I really, really did believe that we were going somewhere and we actually could change the political face of this country.
Immigrants have now had 3 decades to settle into multiracial Britain. Race mixing is a reality. Today, Tyndall leads a different political party, at least in name. He still believes it's the Jews who are behind it all. Do you honestly believe that the Jews are conspiring to undermine the British race?
I said some Jews. I didn't say all Jews.
No, it was a large enough number to form a conspiracy.
I think a conspiracy which has many facets and certainly many Gentile agents as well.
The notion of conspiracy was to become ever more important in count when set against the crimes of the multiracial conspirators.
This country has been betrayed and sold down the river by people acting within the law. And I don't think their crimes the crimes that are being committed against the British people by the promotion of the black invasion and the Asian invasion, the crimes committed against the British people by our being railroaded into Europe by Ted Heath and by people since Ted Heath, they are crimes as far as I'm concerned. And the fact that they were crimes committed within the law doesn't make them any the less crimes. What you're trying to do is to highlight a few cases of things that happened outside the law. Let's take the whole moral picture of what has to be, of what has been done to this country, largely within the law.
For Tyndall, it's all so simple. The BNP are fighting for the British nation's very survival. So why doesn't the British public support them? Because the BNP believe we've all been brainwashed.
It's a simple question. Is somebody who has one black grandparent and three white grandparents white?
I've told you, and I'll tell you again, and I'll go on telling you 20 more times, if I have to, that we will take each individual case on its merits.
So some people with three white grandparents and one black would be white, and others won't.
We will decide at the time.
There is a logic to repatriation which is too grim for even the leader of the BNP to articulate. The far right still wants to save the white British race.
Welcome to Voice of Albion on the White Network. Part 8, John Tyndall, the 11th Hour. First you heard some of a documentary called The Lost Race, History of the National Front. Although it aired in 1999 in Britain, I included it as it retrospectively ties up the events in previous podcasts. There seems to be a lull in national activity during the 80s. Combat 18 came around during these uncertain years, and they will be covered in the next episode of VOA. Media-wise, there seems to be very little regarding nationalism in the 1980s available from Britain. I think the skinhead kind of culture, slightly aligned to the punk culture, continued. There was definitely nationalism around. I remember as a child being with my parents in the city centre and would often see like groups of skinheads with the braces and all the rest of it. But following the collapse of the National Front, discussed in the previous podcast, and the sort of process of all different people going to different groups and splinter groups, and there seems to be a bit of a lost decade in the 80s. The Lost Race documentary was 48 minutes long, so I edited it down. Note, at the start of the documentary, the narrator says the far right in Britain by 1999 had become tiny. That was true to an extent. However, 2 years later, in 2001, the BNP achieved a massive breakthrough in the north of England. 6 years earlier, the BNP had got their first candidate elected in the Isle of Dogs in London under John Tyndall. Therefore, this programme was propaganda, playing down the possibility of nationalist success following the 1979 collapse of the NF. On to Chapter 10 of the 11th Hour, Roots of the British Sickness, the Political System. JT starts, years of observation and study of the British scene have convinced me that our old political system militates against the possibility of good national leadership, except in the very rarest of circumstances. The abysmal quality of most of the public figures we have produced within living memory testifies to this. This system also results in a fragmented and divided national community, incapable of being geared to any great constructive effort on the nation's behalf. Only in the last two world wars has there been any change from this pattern, and even there the slowness of transformation from a slack, splintered and weakly led nation to an organised, united and firmly led one was victory, if it can be called that, would not have been possible had we not been part of coalitions overwhelmingly superior to their adversaries in numbers and material. JT continues, in almost every department of our national life, it is normal to stress the value of team spirit, in the forces, in industry, and on the playing field, just to quote three prominent examples. Yet in the most important area of all, that of national politics, our affairs are organised so as to make team spirit impossible. The body politic is a battleground of warring factions and interests, busy tearing each other and the nation apart. This ongoing civil war, our masters tell us, is part of our heritage of freedom, in quotes. In other words, we cannot consider ourselves free men and women except when living under a political system which ensures that the energies of political leaders are turned against each other in a never-ending party fight, instead of harnessed together in constructive national works. JT contends that a moment's adult thought will dismiss this proposition as ludicrous. He invites us to examine the workings of the party game they call democracy, to see which, to what extent it really has anything to do with freedom, whether in fact any such freedom, in meaningful terms, exists at all. JT recalls an earlier chapter when he related in his younger days how he observed the party candidates and their supporters coming round to homes at election times begging for the people's votes, never of course having time to tell the electors why they should vote for the candidate in question, but only to give an ingratiating smile before passing on to the next house. On the rare occasions when political discussion comes into the act at all, it is at such a juvenile level that the mind boggles at the thought of the destinies of great nations being decided on such a basis. And should the elector have the temerity to raise any real issues of importance, giving rise to embarrassment on part of the canvasser, the latter will take a sudden glance at his watch and find a reason for an urgent departure with the most hasty of farewells. JT then talks of the mass media being the primary source of information on which the voter makes his choice. The BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, JT states, is run by a board of governors appointed by the government of the day. The commercial networks are owned, as is the case with the press, by powerful moneyed interests and rely for most of their income on advertisements placed with them by similar big moneyed interests. As with the press, JT points out, effective control is always in the hands of small minorities. He then asks, just how much freedom of choice, for instance, has a voter who wishes Britain to withdraw from the European Union or wants us to become again a monoracial society, if the candidates competing for his vote represent the Conservative, Labour or Liberal Democrat parties, all pledged to policies opposite to those in which he believes? The organised parties outside the favoured pale of the establishment, that is, not backed by the media or enjoying a seal of their approval, are at a distinct disadvantage. With the media smearing or slandering such parties or dismissing their challenge as irrelevant, the public can, without difficulty, be induced not to vote for them, even though their policies may find favour with a great many electors. On elections, JT continues, the parties with which I have been involved have faced exactly this situation. Our efforts to bid for public support at the polls have brought us face to face with the crippling handicaps involved in campaigning without mass media sanction. And we have learned from this experience that elections in this country, whatever the pretensions of democracy are, simply media rigged. It is possible to beat the racket, but only after many years of patient spade work in building up a nationwide organisation with the resources to meet the media on equal terms, and the coming times of total breakdown and crisis, which will render all the old and orthodox prescriptions discredited. We know that that time will come, and we are now preparing for it, but this does not invalidate our contention that a racket is what the present system is. We can apply no other description to the existing party game, the rules of which are carefully designed to exclude any contender who does not carry establishment blessing. JT lists additional hurdles for racial nationalist parties in Britain. I have indicated the obstacles in the way of anyone who may try to found a new political party with policies in keeping with the desires of this huge, unenfranchised section of the electorate. What will also be an obstacle is the fact that vast resources and money are needed to keep in operation any party able to even have an outside challenger for power. Ordinary member subscriptions are quite inadequate for this purpose. Large funding from powerful moneyed institutions are also needed, be these trade unions or large private or public companies. Democracy, in brackets, thereby becomes not government of the people, but government of the people by servants of the big financial interests, and specifically for those interests. And what of the candidates who covet the people's votes, JT asks? Are they required to have established any proven competence in politics, administration or government? Not a bit of it. The successful candidate who gets elected to Parliament can be a total ignoramus on such matters. All that he needs is, first, to be a good party man, loyal to the prevailing party line and thereby to get adopted by his local constituency organisation, then, so as to prevail over his rivals in the election itself, perhaps to be photogenic, perhaps to show prodigious energy in shaking hands and kissing babies, but above all to be a representative of the party currently in the danger of ascendancy in the seesawing national popularity contest. The prospect, if you think about it for a moment, JT says, is frightening. If we want the brakes of our car repaired, we go to a qualified motor mechanic. Otherwise, we could meet premature death on the road. If we require a complicated throat operation, we put ourselves in the hands of a trained surgeon who specialises in that field. If we have to fight an intricate court action, we hire a professional lawyer. Yet in the most complex field of all, and in the most serious, in its consequences for the greatest number of people, we put our trust in unknown folk who are largely amateurs, in the administration of the nation's political affairs, competence in which should require many more years' training than in any of these trades or professions, and in which the results of failure are far more grave because they affect the entire nation and its millions of inhabitants. We choose men and women who, for all we know, have no capability in the profession whatsoever. JT points out, even when MPs are present in Parliament, the way they vote bears very little relation to the views of their constituents. He uses capital punishment as an example. This issue has again and again proved the point. In the 1960s, capital punishment, the death penalty, was abolished. Motions that it should be restored have been defeated in Parliament. Yet opinion poll after opinion poll shows that an overwhelming majority of electors are in favour of its restoration. We owe our democratic institutions, so we are told, partly to the cultural legacy handed down to us from the city-state of Athens, and partly to the Age of Enlightenment, mainly coinciding with the 18th century, which laid foundations of modern liberalism. But in fact, JT states, such ancestry has little connection with the way our political system operates today. The Athenians, who determined the great public issues of their time, constituted an elite of the population, distinguished from other inhabitants by intelligence and education, and rigidly separated from them by a social system not dissimilar to the former apartheid system in South Africa. They were, in addition, a leisured class with little else to do but immerse themselves in the study and conduct of public affairs, for which they were firmly schooled by family tradition. In a word, they were aristocracy. To contrast, JT writes, just what correspondence to the aristocratic tradition of Athenian democracy and just what atmosphere of reason can be found in contemporary Westminster may be gleaned from many a viewing of parliamentary proceedings on television. What will be seen and heard is not a debate conducted between people of superior intelligence, least of all one taking place in an atmosphere of reason, but an orgy of hysterical noise more appropriate to feeding time at the zoo, an almost non-stop bedlam as the party warriors on each side of the house bawl abuse at each other, sometimes punctuated by vain cries for order from the speaker's chair. Quite apart from the time and energies they contend in the party fight, JT continues, our politicians are never able to apply themselves to the carrying out of wise and far-sighted policies of national development, for the very obvious reason that such tasks must always take second place to that of furthering the party interest. To every party politician, all policies and all endeavours are geared to one object which overrides everything, the winning of the next election. It cannot be otherwise. Even when there is quite sincere and genuine desire to serve the national good, the mind of the party politician simply cannot conceive of such a good being severed except by means of his own party being in office. And yet, these are exactly the conditions under which government is carried on in Britain. Through our party system, everything is unsettled, nothing is of permanence, and every policy has to be evaluated in terms of its vote-winning potential and its efficacy in pleasing the powerful pressure groups on which the survival of government and parties largely depends. On the masses' voting habits, JT comments, they cast their votes with all the frivolity of an amateur punter at the races, moved by nothing more than a momentary fancy or whim, or perhaps the latest tipster's forecast that they have read. If any deviate from that rule, it is simply to vote for the party for whom they, and usually their fathers and grandfathers, have always voted for, without the slightest attempt to examine seriously the programme on which that party presently campaigns, or indeed, its record when in power. Quick note, this is very true, as anyone who has campaigned in Britain will know. Anyone who has spoken to people while campaigning will be familiar with the phrase, "I'm voting Labour, my family always has." If you ask them about Labour's policies on immigration or foreign aid, they will usually say they don't agree with Labour's policies on immigration or foreign aid. Continue. For government in Britain is not democratic government. It is oligarchic government, operating within a purely nominal framework of democratic institutions and procedures, nor is it oligarchic government of the type that might be justified, an oligarchy bound in devotion to nation and people, and the guardian of their welfare. It is oligarchy which, at least in modern times, has been consistent in its portrayal of nation and people at every junction of affairs. In the hands of this oligarchy of power, the politicians and their parties have become nothing better than marionettes. That's a puppet work by string, I had to look that up. To be paraded before the people, each at his appointed hour, and then withdrawn from the stage as soon as he has served his purpose. To be replaced by new performers with a new act, though of course manipulated by the same puppet masters behind the stage. Needless to say, the retiring marionettes are usually well pensioned off by being given plum jobs outside the political arena at very high salaries. Perhaps in the city, perhaps in Europe. It matters not that they have displayed total incompetence when in political office. Their golden handshakes will be generous, in the extreme, for that is the bait required to keep them well in line beforehand. JT then talks about the trick of introducing and building up, via the media, new parties, at times when the establishment senses discontent. The current example of this is the party called United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP. Their leader has been on the main debating show in Britain, Question Time, no fewer than on 25 occasions. They have had a favourable press which is totally out of relation to their size and importance. Here I'll play a clip from 2009 at the West Midlands Euro elections count, where myself and colleagues were in attendance, hoping to get a BNP MEP elected.
The ins and outs of European elections. The party who want us out got into Europe, while one of those who wants to keep us in was out. A 6% slump in the Labour vote pushed them into a miserable third place behind the Conservatives and UKIP. The BNP failed to match their successes in Northern England. Even in Stoke-on-Trent, where they have 9 councillors, they finished fourth. We'd wondered if the MP's expenses scandal would drive turnouts down or up. Neither. It remained virtually unchanged at just under 36%. Our region's 2 UKIP MEPs seized on their chance to rail against what they see as the failure of the major parties and the media to explain the case for leaving the EU.
BBC TV, please, let's have the European debate. Let's tell the people what Europe really is about.
This Lib Lab con do not believe in democracy. For years and years, you have failed to give the people a voice on Europe, even though you know the majority of people want to leave the European Union. You are nothing better than fascists and dictators. Let's have the voice.
But one of our 2 returning Conservatives said voting patterns pointed the opposite way.
I remind them that 2/3 of the people who voted in this election voted for parties who do not want this country to leave the European Union. That is democracy.
So, our region now has 2 Conservative MEPs, 2 UKIP, 1 Labour and 1 Liberal Democrat. We'd been asking ourselves if there'd be a protest vote for the BNP, perhaps, or the Greens, in the event the none-of-the-above vote coalesced strongly around UKIP to confirm them as a major force in this European Parliament.
JT writes, every so often, of course, the natives get a little more restless than usual and decline to be as enchanted as they are expected to be by this game of musical chairs. They look a little further back in time and recall that the two main gangs have had more than just one chance and have muffed things up each time. They are willing to consider that behind all the talk of change, in quotes, there is not really any change at all. At such moments, a dangerous number of these natives are inclined to say, a plague on both your houses. But our puppet masters are ready for this too, for they always have in reserve a third gang, even if necessary, a fourth one, available to parade before the people to pick up the votes that some of the latter are no longer disputed, at least for the time being, to give to the first two gangs. This is, of course, the reason why the Liberals, now called Liberal Democrats, for longer after they had ceased to be contenders for power in their own right, were kept on ice by the establishment and accorded a certain level of credibility. They provided a useful safety valve for those voters who might get disillusioned with both Tory and Labour. By courtesy of the Guardian newspaper, it was ensured that the Liberal Party did not fade into total oblivion, but, on the contrary, was always there at election time to soak up the protest vote just in case that vote rose to unmanageable proportions. JT then gives other examples of parties being artificially inflated at certain times. He goes on, no meaningful effort to grapple with our immense national problems will be possible until this ludicrous and wholly unworkable system is done away with and we institute an effective system of government capable of bringing to the fore a high calibre of national leadership and then properly equipping that leadership with the necessary powers to action. There will be those, JT announces, who will ask if such a change would threaten the framework of democracy and the freedom of the people that is supposed to lie at the centre of that ideal. To them, let us straight away reply that at present no such framework of democracy exists which can be threatened and no freedom exists for the people to control the processes by which they are governed. Indeed, it is virtually impossible to put the ordinary people of this country in a position of having less power over national affairs and less freedom to choose how they will be governed than they have today, JT states. He adds, an alternative system of government designed to produce leadership of the quality for which I have called and which empowers it to act effectively is by no means incompatible with the objective of giving the people greater freedom and a more influential voice in national affairs. On the contrary, the establishment of such conditions of government would, without question, meet a need that is yearned for by millions of Britons as never before. The next, which must be accepted, JT states, is that it is futile, government being elected, to carry out policies approved by a majority of the people if, from the moment it takes office, it is engaged in a non-stop civil war in Parliament in which every possible device is used to sabotage its effective operation. Likewise, the will of the people, just supposing that we have a way of clearly ascertaining what that is, cannot be carried out by any government effectively if its power of action is hampered at every turn by the need to appease various vested interests and bend to the pressures of the various lobbies invariably representing organised minorities which lay at government's heels. Here, JT comes back to the truth recognised by Mosley in the 1930s and dealt with an earlier chapter. Under the old system, as Mosley said, the power of finance can affect the lives of the mass of people more closely and more terribly in the decision of one afternoon than can Parliament with puny labour and the mock heroics of sham battles in the course of a decade. End quote. No government, JT contends, that is not prepared and equipped to subordinate the power of money, among others, to the nation's political will, can with any honesty claim to be representative of the people, let alone act in the people's name. JT then sets out a list of basic objectives that he believes we should seek in any reform of British politics that one day in the future may be adopted. Number one, first and foremost, we must recruit into political life a much higher calibre of person than is the norm in British politics today. Currently, our men and women of public affairs are simply too small in both mind and character to be able to cope with the great issues with which they are confronted. Whatever means are required to elevate to the top those people with the highest leadership qualities must be adopted. In addition to this, politics must be given the status of a proper profession, which, as with other professions, people can only practice when they have obtained qualifications of proven competence. 2. Government, once elected, must be given proper powers to act in accordance with the will of the people who have elected it. It must be immunised from the pressures of special sectional interest groups, particularly of finance, and be enabled to carry out, unhindered, the policies necessary to the nation's good. 3. A way needs to be found to take party warfare out of politics. The nation cannot be governed well when a large faction in Parliament has a vested interest in it being governed badly. 4. The partisan influence of the mass media upon elections must somehow be drastically reduced, if not eliminated. 5. Political debate needs to be conducted at a much higher level than at present, so that voters, when they go to the polls, are able to make an intelligent choice instead of being harassed by moronic propaganda dealing in trivia. 6. Ministers in charge of the departments of government should be experts in their fields and not amateurs. To bring this about, it should be possible for them to be selected from the pool of managerial talent of the whole population, not solely from elected MPs. 7. The working schedules of our leading politicians must be arranged so that they are able to give their full attention to the vital matters of state for which they are responsible. 8. Parliament's machinery of legislation needs to be drastically speeded up, and legislators should be competent and knowledgeable in the issues on which they are called upon to vote. JT adds, these are statements of general principle. He is the first to acknowledge that realising them in practice is less easy than putting them on paper. In conclusion, JT writes, we would change the Public Order Act so to guarantee freedom of assembly in public places for all political groups and take away the prerogative of the Home Secretary or any public official under him to ban public demonstrations on the grounds of a threatened breach of the peace that opponents might cause. Those who would use unlawful means to prevent others exercising their democratic rights should be the object of firm restraint, not their intended victims. As with the height of meeting halls and broadcasting, these rules would apply to our opponents as much to us. In addition, we would explore measures, where practical, to extend these principles to the press. JT continues, in this chapter I have attempted to point out the unworkability of our present system of government, which in reality scarcely qualifies to be called a system at all. If there is anything systematic about it, it is the unscrupulous exploitation of the credulity of the people by those in power, deluding that they can control government, whereas in fact, government is wholly outside their control. From the standpoint of governing the affairs of the nation, and of the good of the nation, nothing is system, everything is chaos, and the chaos, of course, is an inevitable product of the party war. The whole thing is a squalid political scam, designed to keep certain interests in power for perpetuity, while misleading the masses into thinking they have a free choice, in quotes. In the direction of national affairs, the scam produces only weakness and muddle. In an earlier chapter, JT says, I spoke at length about certain subterranean forces that exercise overwhelming power over British affairs while keeping themselves away from the spotlight of public gaze and thereby from accountability to the nation. I am convinced that until those forces are broken, the nation is going to be without unity, without strength, without purpose, without direction, and without hope. The preservation of existing conditions in British politics is essential to these forces, for it is their principal weapon, Only when that weapon is eliminated will their power be broken. The needs of government, and I have advocated here, are aimed at giving the nation dynamic while responsible leadership, and at the same time preserving the meaningful human freedoms that are part of our national heritage. It is now time to look much more widely and deeply into these questions of freedom and of the balance that must be struck between the rights and duties of citizenship if we are to build a stronger, healthier and more cohesive British society. That's the end of chapter 10. It was a shorter chapter. And next Sunday we'll look at chapter 11 of John Tyndall's 11th Hour, A Call for National Rebirth. Chapter 11 is entitled Freedom, the Illusion and the Reality. I forgot to say at the start that there was a National Front meeting in Birmingham yesterday afternoon. It was chaired by West Midlands National Front officials, and the guest speaker was Kevin Bryan, who is the chairman of the National Front. Unfortunately, there was no recording available due to some internal things being discussed. However, a few people have asked me about the possibility that Kevin Bryan and the new National Front are, you know, not going to tell the whole story, shall we say. All I can say to those people, if you was at the meeting yesterday, world jury was discussed and other such things. So from what I saw and heard yesterday, the National Front is a party worth supporting, and a person I took along, a long-time friend and activist, shares my belief, and he commented that he shall be joining the party soon. Okay, there has not really been any other activism. I think things are winding down this side of Christmas. I am getting a leaflet designed, which I shall be distributing, but I haven't got the leaflet printed yet. Now I'll play out with a speech by Tess Cornane, which was at the 45th anniversary meeting of the National Front in July 2012. I'll also play some other clips from Tess, as she's a long-time nationalist, very brave lady, very inspiring lady, who's also stood in the Greater London Assembly elections in 2012. So I'll play you some clips from Tess Cornane speaking. Best wishes. See you next week. 14 words.
Guest speaker, Tess Cornane.
Hello, everybody, and I'm very pleased to be here, and it's nice to see the faces once again. I know it's a celebration, but I also want to say that while we're celebrating, there's a lot of hard work that's got to be done. I know we're celebrating, we're still here after all these years, and we want to be here for years to come, but there's so much to be done. And as you probably know, I come from Catford, Lewisham, Blackheath, and the radical change there is beyond belief. But yesterday I went to Thornton Heath. Now, I hope if anybody comes from Thornton Heath, they don't think I'm being insulting about where they come from, because coming from Deptford, I can't say anything about anywhere else. But, do you know, I sat in the car and I was appalled. I couldn't believe what I was witnessing. I hardly saw one white face. And I'm not exaggerating. Everybody seemed to be living on the pavement. And, you know, in this country, not only do we not get the weather to live on the pavement, but that's not the way we carry on. We don't go and put our chairs and table and smoke these funny pipes. It's all strange to us. If there was a barber in an area, it was a barber. Everybody knew that he was there to cut the bloke's hair. But now, they're on every corner. There's 3, 4, 5. They're open Sundays. They're open 12 o'clock at night. our way of life has been destroyed. I mean, 45 years ago, when far-sighted patriots got together and formed the National Front, alarm bells were ringing loudly to awaken our nation to the extreme perils the country was facing. The success of the part that the party enjoyed in the 70s seemed to suggest that power would be snatched from the traitors in office and there would be enough support from the electorate to firmly establish a nationalist government. Alas, it was not to be. A combination of infighting, an assault either by poison pens of the left-wing journalists or hired scum that mounted physical attacks on decent patriots, which on one occasion culminated in the tragic death of an honourable man. I refer, of course, to Albert Mariner. And unless I am very much mistaken, I cannot recall anyone being called to justice for that murder, because murder it was. These things combined seem to assure our enemies that the National Front would be no threat at all to their comfortable, exclusive club that our enemies and their treacherous establishment puppets enjoyed. The fickle electorate were easy prey for the lies and distortions that were constantly printed or broadcast on a daily basis, either blatantly or subliminally. Programmes such as Till Death Do Us Part, do we remember that one? Love Thy Neighbour. They did their work well, and most people reacted accordingly. They laughed at the bigots portrayed in these programmes, such as these, you've got to be nice to your neighbour, you must look after them. We began to accept any other race. Hence the trap was set. And all aspects of our life and our way of life were eroded. Now, with regard to the programmes I mentioned, I don't think at the time the word racist was in vogue. It seems that only nationalists in this country fully understand the evil connotation connected with this word and the reasons that the British people are constantly bombarded with it. It seems to me that there is a high degree of hypocrisy when our traitorous politicians implement their draconian race laws. A glaring example of this is the way in which the Germans are treated. If any German tourists, many of whom weren't even born until decades after the Second World War, were to walk down Tooley Street, South East London, they would see a picture of Hitler on the London dungeons, advertising the London dungeons. When I say a picture of Hitler, it's a large picture, a portrait. This, of course, instills in all visiting Germans a feeling of extreme guilt over something they had nothing to do with. It would be more appropriate, in my opinion, if Robert Mugabe, his portrait was on display. But of course, reminding people of Hitler doesn't do what it should and remind people of the ultimate sacrifice our brave young men and women were forced to make in the war that our politicians started. No, Hitler's portrait is on prominent display to somehow equate British nationalists with Nazism in the brainwashed minds of many Britons. Most people in this country don't seem to question the motives of the traitors that run this country. They swan along. They don't seem to see further than their nose. And I hate to say this about my own race, but I am ashamed. You know, I'm ashamed that they're... I don't know if they're cowards, which is a strong word. I don't know. perhaps selfishness comes into it, perhaps greed comes into it, but basically, I think they're cowards. Because we were given this country as caretakers. Right. You look after your house, you're only a caretaker, don't care whether you're a council tenant or you own your house. You've got a garden shed. You don't destroy everything in it, do you? You look after it. Having said that, but still, I'm saying when you're given something as precious as land and a future and all the things that we should be grateful for, and we're having them taken away from us. Why, for example, is it perfectly acceptable that Scottish nationalists, Welsh nationalists, and even Irish nationalists, for the most part, they support the IRA? Why is it that these nationalists are allowed airtime? They're in the newspaper. They can speak to anybody freely. But British nationalists are demonised. They're not allowed on the radio, the television, or in newspapers. The obvious answer, my friends, and I know you know this, you don't need me to tell you this, is to bring about the breakup of the Union. Thus divide and conquer and destroy our collective strength forever. And I mean forever. Because we are not going to get it back. Nobody here, even that young girl, she won't see it. Because once it's gone, do the British people know? Do they know what they are losing? Do they know what the heritage? Do they know the future that they're giving away to people that could care less about this country? Almost half a century ago, when this party was formed, conditions in this country were beginning to appear bleak as far as the future looked. And despite Enoch Powell's grim warning, not enough people were prepared to contemplate a future where Indigenous Britons would be second-class citizens. That is a stark reality now. We took no notice of the intelligent man. We weren't bothered. We couldn't care less. And I was probably part of that too. But, the evidence was there then. It was there 45 years ago. And only a handful of people recognised it. For the last 40 years, we, who are racial nationalists, have suffered in bewildered disbelief the capitulation of non-nationalists amongst our fellow countrymen and women, realising as we do that we are now an occupied country. Yeah, yeah, great. We are governed by treacherous, low-lives who gladly point out to the rest of the world, and the rest of the world believe it, how free we are in this country. How lucky we are. That's why they all come here, because they think we're free, we got it made. But all the time, they are eroding on an hourly basis. I wouldn't say a weekly, but on an hourly basis. Any freedom we once had. And the operative word is had. So time is of the essence. What we've got to save. I'll give you an example. For instance, anywhere on earth, the government spring into action if there's a flood. Oh, we'll send thousands of taxpayers, millions of taxpayers' money. We'll sort them out. Go up the north of England, Yorkshire. Those people are flood victims. They've got to wait months, if not years, to get a claim off the insurance company. I feel sure that a nationalist government, under such circumstances, would at once declare a state of emergency. And aid would, I hope, be immediate. But this never seems to occur to most people in this country. And they continue to vote into high office those who betray the British people. Not just now and again, but constantly betray us. during the last 5 or 6 decades of the nightmare that we go through in this country, the NF was formed and, despite almost insurmountable odds, has continued to be a beacon of hope and light for the beleaguered British people, a lifeline held out to a nation drowning in a sea of tyranny and oppression. And we have arrived at a point now in our history that there is no other salvation except through the party that I'm sure most of us belong to here. Mm-hmm. All other so-called parties, the nationalist parties, have lost all credibility in my eyes. The once powerful BNP is fast disintegrating through a catalogue of tactical blunders, lies, megalomania.
True, very true.
It has fallen to us in the National Front to save our country. And I firmly believe that we were born to be patriots, almost chosen, I hope, by Almighty God to save our country from the onslaught of evil that we have been and are still being subjected to. So when we leave here, my friends, today, after celebrating, which I hope you've seen another side to my speech, I am celebrating, I am grateful, I will be eternally grateful for the National Front. I hope when we leave here, after this celebration and the achievements of the National Front over the years, I hope it's been a pleasure, it has been for me, to be amongst like-minded people and people that I will always call friends and have made my life what it is. Thank you.
To have the next one up on the count, and it is Tess, who did very well last time round, and we hope to do
better. Our esteemed Prime Minister stated recently on television that our troops are in Afghanistan to ensure our country is safe. Oh. Safe. Do you feel safe? Shall we do a poll outside here and see how many people feel safe in this country? There's not going to be many. We have sustained an onslaught of terror from the baby killers of the IRA, as we all know, murderers, rapists, muggers, drug dealers, knife-wielding thugs and armed gangs in our streets, in our hospitals, and sometimes even in our homes. David Cameron is either a traitor or on a par with Edward Heath, or an absolute congenital idiot. With regard to muggers, I've always said many, many times before, there is no such word in my vocabulary as mugger. There's armed robbery, there's robbery with violence, which should be dealt with under the rule of law, as it always once was. And I assume, actually, when Mr Cameron said we were all safe in this country, he also implied that we were free. Free. Can you speak openly now, anywhere? Can you look in the direction of a foreigner without he takes or she takes an offence? Free, what does he mean by free? I haven't felt free for years.
Yeah, sure.
We are still under threat from atrocities, either from a resurgent IRA or a crazed fanatic who perpetrated the 7/7 London bombings. A 12-year-old child wasn't free when she was run over by a parasitic freeloading illegal so-called asylum seeker who left the child trapped under his car and fled the scene of the crime, leaving the child to die in terror and agony. She wasn't allowed to be free. She wasn't free to grow up in her own country with her own people instead of a multicultural hellhole that contributed to her terrible death. Her father wasn't free when he cradled her in his arms when she died, a man that cannot have any more children. He's got to live with that for the rest of his life. Not only that, the child's killer was given permission to stay in this country because he is entitled, the judge said, to a family life.
Shame, shame on it all.
Even though the dead child's father, as I said before, couldn't have any more children, has been denied the right to a family life. Not only did his beloved daughter die in his arms, something that he will never forget, but to compound his grief, he was refused justice. One wonders what the outcome would have been had the judge's daughter suffered the same death, or the traitorous establishment, any member of their families had died the same way. These people are forever reminding us that we are all equal. The classic case of some being more equal than others. Turning to the London Olympics, it is patently obvious that the taxpayer will be lumbered with the bill for not years, decades. The argument for these games is that it will be good for Britain's prestige in the world. Really? Prestige in the world?
Indeed.
Since the world already knows that our politicians are corrupt with regard to their expenses, and that the Royal Navy stood by and witnessed Somalian criminals who glory in the name of pirates, abduct two Britons from Tunbridge Wells, also viewed on world television, other Royal Navy ratings captured and paraded in front of the TV cameras, saw homecoming troops abused and poppies burned, saw police constables standing by and doing nothing while scum looted and burned our cities. Referring to what Richard said when he looked out and saw that, when I was a very young child, I remember looking out and seeing a wall of fire at the almost at the bottom of my garden, because I lived very near the Thames at the time. They'd set light to the Thames. That must have felt something like that. Invasion, fear, wondering what the hell was going on in our country. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know. That was part of my life. But since then, the tragedy is really heart-rending to people that really have known this country years and years ago. Everything is so drastically different. Nothing's changed. I can't think of one thing that's changed for the better.
That's right. Very true.
Not one
Very
thing.
True. Very true.
I think the world prestige, as you know, the Prime Minister wanted to believe that we were going to get through the Olympics, I think that's a misnomer. And with regard to the criminals, it is very strange that over time they become glamorised. Pirates, highwaymen, smugglers, and everyone criminal. They're criminals, these people. An enemy of society. And yet the very name sometimes make people go silly. Oh, you know, a smuggler, pirate. Oh, whippy. There's something special. They're dangerous. Let us hope and pray that this country returns to sanity and elects a truly British, patriotic, nationalist government, and future generations are taught how a nationalist government restored law and order, and the criminals that we of this generation were faced with are regarded with contempt and disgust. Then, and only then, Mr. Cameron, will we be truly safe and free. Turning now to the GLA campaign, we all know time is running out. 4 years. I mean, I remember saying a few years ago, well, we've only got about 20 years. You know, we haven't got 20 years before this country's finished.
That's right.
We haven't got 20 years before we're outnumbered. We haven't got 20 years to do nothing. We've got to work so hard. And another 4 years of either Boris or the other chap, Livingston, well, you know, I can't believe we're faced with the choice of those two. I really can't. And now they've got this Carlos Cordillas, which I think is an absolute insult to the members of the Nationalist Party. I mean, Griffin called me a bigot. But anyway, we'll see about that. I called him a traitor. And that was the last word I spoke. Seriously, though, I am really honoured to be standing for the National Front. We're so needed. This party is so important now to the people of Britain. They must realise that the National Front is their salvation. There's nothing else. There's nowhere else they can go. And hopefully, please God, there will be more people in this next election that will realise this. I know it's going to take some time. We keep saying it slowly, slowly, and it will take time. But we haven't got a lot of time left. And so the message has got to be to our people, you must trust us. We will deal with it. The National Front will deal with our problems. There's nowhere else to go, I don't think. And do the traitors who govern and aspire to govern us think or imagine in their supreme arrogance that patriots would not form a brotherhood and sisterhood of resistance to oppose their treachery? How deluded they are. Do they not know that we will never give up our country? And a day will surely come, my friends, when the tune is called, but the piper will be paid in full. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Voice of Albion on the White Network.